Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
The issue at Stanford and elsewhere was sometimes posed in strict either-or terms. Students had to read either black women and third world contemporaries or the dead white males of the European past. Either Homer or Toni Morrison.
I've indicated to you that the nature of life in the Galilee was an overarching, unifying interest that brought us all together. We wanted to come up with, in the dirt and in historical reconstruction, what it meant to live in the first centuries of the Common Era in ancient Galilee, where Jesus and the rabbis lived side by side.
Archaeology in Roman Palestine and the Liberal Arts in America. Two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion with Carol and Eric Myers of Duke University. Following that, a conversation with Robert Connor, recently appointed director of the National Humanities Center. Since 1970, Carol and Eric Myers have directed an archaeological program in Israel. Among their recent investigations is a mosaic floor located in the Galilean city of Sepphoris. Here is Eric Myers.
The nature of ancient Judaism in the Galilee has been the subject of inquiry both by Jewish and Christian scholars for hundreds of years. The Sepphoris project got underway in attempting to answer some of the important issues that have arisen over the recent centuries with respect to the origins of Christianity and the nature of Judaism in the Galilee. You must remember that Sepphoris is just 3 kilometers away, as the crow flies, from Nazareth, the historic birthplace of Jesus. And the major city, the major urban metropolis that is close by is Sepphoris. It has an ancient theater there. It is a city like unto New York City, like Chicago. It is a major urban center with all the cultural ambiance that that would imply. So undertaking to excavate a city enabled us to explore the entire cultural orbit and milieu of this region. So there is a sense in which we can reconstruct everyday life better, even, from some of the everyday artifacts than we can from the more dramatic finds. So we've had a combination of both normal routine discoveries and dramatic unique discoveries.
Carol, tell me about this mosaic.
Well, the mosaic that was discovered at ancient Sepphoris first in the summer of 1987 and then explored further, re-excavated in the summer of 1988, has been perhaps the most spectacular discovery of all at ancient Sepphoris for many reasons, one of which is that nothing like it has ever been discovered in the East Mediterranean before. Now, other mosaics exist, there's no question about that. But this is in a remarkably good state of preservation, for one, and its artistic quality is of a very high nature.
What's it about? Does it tell a story? I mean, we don't have the benefit of pictures here, but can you summarize for me? Help me to understand what's going on this mosaic, Eric?
Well, I would entitle the storyline The Life and Times of the God Dionysus. And this is very curious. This is a Jewish and Christian town in the time in which this mosaic exists, the second, third century of the Common Era, A.D. And Dionysus is normally associated with Greco-Roman culture, Hellenistic culture, Hellenistic civilization.
The god of good times, right?
The god of good times. This is a god of Saturday night on the college campus. This is a god of wine and beer, you know, the god of afterlife and vegetation and all of these things. So it's a bit curious. So there in this wonderful banquet hall, set aside for feasting and public meetings and drinking of wine, sits Dionysus in symposium, with the Heracles of old. And so there are 15 panels surrounding this central label of Dionysus, Life and Times, which tell various aspects of his life, of the mythology, and of ancient reflections about the importance of Dionysus in everyday life. I might say that Dionysus is also, perhaps less known, but also associated with the theater. Hmm. And this building in which this banquet hall is located, perhaps an inn for actors, is physically adjacent to the ancient theater of Sepphoris.
Well, what was the function of the mosaic? Did it was it like walking into a shopping mall and looking at displays? Was it like going into a cathedral and understanding a narrative in that sense? What was its social function? Carol Myers?
First of all, let me make clear that it was on the floor of the building. It wasn't hung on the wall. And it's sometimes called a carpet, a mosaic carpet. It was, as Eric just said, it was within a large room, which was probably a banquet hall in a palatial building, whose the exact function of which we're not entirely clear. But it was a public room, and very interesting is the way that the arrangements for seating were made in this room. There are actual marks in the mosaic floor that show that benches were to be put around the outside of the mosaic picture. It's very different from what we do in our dining rooms today, where we have beautiful oriental rugs and then we put our dining room tables plunk on top of them and we can't see them. In this ancient banquet hall, it was part of the entertainment, in a sense, of the evening's festivities. And people sat in lounging banquettes around the mosaic and probably strolled around it as they came in and took in the various scenes, which are facing outwards. They're not all lined up in the same way. In that way, people on all sides of the mosaic had a chance and were meant to follow the story of Dionysus.
Is it is the mosaic typical of the kind of thing that would constitute, what, the social discourse in this time? Are we talking about the haves and the have-nots? Are we talking about high society and low society? Are there ways to figure that out?
We're talking about high society. From the level of the art and the engineering.
Very sophisticated.
Very sophisticated at every level, both in the conception of the paneling, in the rendering of the artistic motifs, and in the actual inlaying of the mosaic stone tiles. In every aspect, this is top of the line, top quality, and it's quite possible that the artist was imported from Italy or other part of the Eastern Mediterranean and received a darn big fee. There's no doubt about that. It would have been expensive.
Do you know anything about the artist, Carol?
Well, mosaics are not signed, but the discovery of this mosaic actually has made scholars who deal with mosaic art in antiquity take a new look at the waves of influence in mosaic art. Now, previously, Eastern Mediterranean mosaic art was believed to have somehow originated to the northeast of Palestine, somewhere in Syria, perhaps in the area of Antioch. But the quality of this mosaic floor seems to be superior in some ways, and now people are suggesting that maybe there was a Palestinian school of mosaics that exported its expertise and its artistic talent to regions far away. There's a tendency to kind of whitewash the early centuries and to look at Christianity as somehow emerging fully formed and distinct from Judaism.
Right.
And the sustained habitation at sites like Sepphoris of groups that somehow recognize both their Jewish roots and their new values or theologies associated with the function of Jesus Christ has not been given the kind of recognition that perhaps it should be. And I think that our work at Sepphoris will contribute to that dialogue.
Let me ask you to pursue that a moment, Carol. You've written a book about Eve. Does the Sepphoris Project lend any insight into the function, the role of women in early Christianity and Judaism as it existed then?
One is that the cult of Dionysus, for reasons that I'm not clear about myself yet, seems to have been a particular favorite of women. And there were women activists, women followers of Dionysus that were prominent, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean form of Dionysus religion, which may mean that there was a contingent of Roman women at Sepphoris who functioned very actively. The second thing I would point to is part of the mosaic that we haven't really spoken about yet. Yes, it does contain as its central focus the life and times of Dionysus, but surrounding those themes, surrounding those panels dealing with Dionysus, are other panels in which, although one of them is broken, but one of them is still beautifully preserved, in which there are portraits of women. And one of these portraits, the one that is so beautifully preserved, is the one that perhaps drew the most attention of all to the site.
And you call her the Mona Lisa?
You knew, right.
Tell me about that.
Well, it's an absolutely spectacular representation of a woman. And it kind of transcends any local or provincial ideas about female beauty, at least in the opinion of most everyone who's seen her. And that would be represented on this mosaic floor in a very prominent place is perhaps some other aspect of the role of women in the, at least in the Roman portion of the social configuration of ancient Sepphoris.
Mm-hmm. I want to now turn both to the question of the language on the mosaic and the language from inscriptions around the site.
Why? Why is that important?
Because the language in the inscriptions, which is contemporary with the publication of the Mishnah, is Greek. Now, you could, as many people have assumed, that this mosaic and all the labels in Greek is intended solely for the exclusive use of the Roman pagan community.
And that isn't necessarily the case, huh?
Absolutely not, because it's adjacent to the Acropolis area where we have excavated domestic units that are clearly Jewish or Christian.
Carol?
Let me just interject one point that may not be clear. Even though this is in the Roman period, and Latin is the language of the Roman Empire, in the eastern part of the empire, Greek continued into this period as the language of the Roman population.
I see.
And perhaps of others, as Eric has been saying.
Uh-huh. Eric?
And if we look at some of the chance finds that have turned up through the years from the cemetery or catacombs of ancient Sepphoris, they're predominantly in Greek. So it's fair to say that the Greek language existed side by side with Hebrew, which may already be a kind of language of the academy. Greek is the everyday language of the street, everyday language of this part of Galilee. So from the time that Sepphoris became ornament of the Galilee, administrative Galilee, Galilean capital by the son of Herod the Great, Herod Antipas, in the first century when Jesus was there, this site surely, in order to survive and flourish as it did, had to function day to day in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the evidence from this region of ancient Palestine is predominantly in Greek.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation about the Sepphoris Project. Eric and Carol Myers, implicit in what you've just been saying, Eric, is the notion of, what do we call it, a divided land, a divided sensibility. That's certainly nothing new when we look at the Middle East. That is to say, cultures coexisting, one next to the other, languages, that sort of thing. Are there, in fact, fruitful historical analogies that we might draw as you look at Sepphoris now, Sepphoris then, in the context of the Middle East? Eric?
I'd like to think of language as a unifier, and the existence of Greek in broad regions of the ancient world of Palestine in the Roman era brought people together. It brought Jews and Christians and pagans together in the marketplace, and it unified them. The Hebrew language was the exclusive domain of the sages. Not even the normal Jews on the street could probably get around in the highfalutin Hebrew of the rabbinic sages. But we can look for historical analogies. I think one of the surprising and endearing elements of this enterprise is that we see a variety of communities existing side by side. And perhaps there were four of them at Sepphoris: the Jewish community, the Judeo-Christian community, the Christian community ultimately, and the Roman pagan community. They lived in this city of 20, 25,000 side by side. It's not clear whether they had separate areas in town in which they lived. At the moment, it looks like they commingled. They had integrated neighborhoods and coexisted. They shared water resources. They shared agricultural resources in the nearby area. They brought in their water resources from 15 kilometers away in a common aqueduct with several side entryways that they all shared in and paid taxes for. So we see a picture of communities existing side by side in a very complex, diverse area.
Are you implying the possibility of harmony here as we look at the Middle East today? You know, you pick up the papers and you say, you remember the old Kingston Trio song, they're rioting in Africa, there's nothing new about this. It just seems to go on and nothing improves. Is there harmony implicit in what you're describing here?
I'd like not to over-exaggerate. There is a degree of harmony. We know from the literature, the literary sources of this period, that there's a good deal of theological self-definition going on. Hmm. And the Jewish community was trying to define itself vis-a-vis the emerging Christian community. And their attentions reflected in the literature. Of that, there is no doubt. But to see these communities existing side by side, I think is very helpful corrective on that emphasis that is preserved in the literature. Hmm. So there's a kind of social harmony, there's a kind of coexistence. And we needn't take, therefore, at face value, what the pattern that we see in the old city of Jerusalem today, for example.
That's
the Christians live in their little corner, yeah. The Muslims live in Muslim quarter, and the Jews live in the Jewish quarter. Huh. We can see rather a community more integrated than that, perhaps.
How about this, Carol? Mark?
Well, I'd like to point out something about Sepphoris in relation to this. It is a city of this kind of mixed population, and in that sense, it differs from many, if not most, other settlements in Galilee, if not all ancient Palestine at this time. There were other cities that had this kind of mixed population, but there weren't many. And I think it's no accident that, at least in terms of Jewish creativity, that it takes place at this kind of metropolitan site or cosmopolitan site, in which there are other influences, in which there are other ideas and other populations. And as Eric said a few minutes ago, it facilitated a process of self-definition, of self-inquiry. Who are we in the face of other peoples who claim to be something else? What do we share with them, and what sets us out? What makes us unique? What are our own cultural patterns? And I think that that may have been the process for all the communities in such a mixed site. We sometimes call this process creative symbiosis. That is, the different communities that live side by side in consideration of how they were the same and yet differed from the other communities had to reflect upon their own values and their own ideas and develop them in ways which have had enormous continuity with subsequent traditions and subsequent generations.
Quick footnote to our conversation, Eric and Carol Myers. Our talk has been pretty serious. Is this fun, what you two do at the Sepphoris Project? Do you enjoy it? Is it like, oh boy, you know, go away for another summer and work on this thing?
We love doing it in the dirt. That's what we always refer to our activities. If we wouldn't like working outside in the heat and all of the terrible hours that we keep, we wouldn't be doing it.
Keeps you lean and mean, huh?
Yeah. There are two aspects of it that I would like to underscore. One is the fact that we generate new data constantly. So right. we are deeply physically involved with the task of recovering the past.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the fellowship and friendships that one makes on a dig are of a kind that last forever. I mean, we have a following of our students, nearly 1,000 students we've taken with us to our digs over the past two decades.
Mm-hmm.
And we remember them by name, we correspond, we have reunions, and there's a wonderful fellowship that's generated by it.
Carol, I'll give you the last word.
Right. Well, I always say people ask me why I do this over and over again, subject myself to the trials and tribulations of fieldwork, that it's a socially acceptable way to grow up and still to play in the dirt. But I would add to that an intensification of what Eric said about the human element of the archaeological quest itself, the contemporary human element, that as we bring students, it's pedagogy at its best. It's experiential learning both for us and for the students with whom we work.
Carol and Eric Myers teach at Duke University. They serve as co-directors of the Sepphoris Project in Israel. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring the center's new president and director. He is Robert Connor, formerly a professor of classics at Princeton University. Well, now, one of the bugbear words that I recall from the 60s and 70s was this wonderful problem and challenge of relevance, making the great books, as they're called, important in the lives of young people who may not be thinking in terms of these great, noble themes when they come to undergraduate education. For example, at Princeton, did you find that kind of a problem?
Well, I think to some extent that's a problem everywhere. We've been through, and perhaps we're still in for a while, an era where careerism has been a very prominent feature in American higher institutions of higher education. But these texts people keep coming back to. Ezra Pound, you know, defined a classic at one point as news that stays news.
Right.
And
right.
I like that definition.
He also said, make it new. That's one of the problems that's going on in the academy. We have a lot of professors who are saying, come on, man, give me a break. I'm tired of all those dead white European males. I want to start looking at some things that are relevant, that are important to this culture today, that are political. They have ideological overtones, and that creates a lot of fussing in the academy. Got this right?
It sure does. No, that's a difficult issue. But many of those people have posed it in what seemed to me to be somewhat misleading terms. They phrased it as a sharp either-or dichotomy. I mean, either you read Homer, a dead white male, or you read Toni Morrison, and you have to choose one or the other.
Uh-huh. Bob Connor, what about the charge of elitism, that in the humanities we have the problem of teaching the creme de la creme? We are overlooking a lot of the neglected constituents in our society. You think there's any fairness to that charge? What should we do about it? How do we address it?
Well, I think it's important, first off, not to confuse the humanities and the texts within them with the possessions of any individual ethnic or population group. The fact that a work was written by a dead white male doesn't mean that it's only relevant for dead white males.
Mm-hmm.
Reading Toni Morrison, for example, I get a very strong sense both of the extent to which the Bible is right in the marrow of her bones. It's a text that she knows and is incorporated. And indeed, that's probably true for Homer as well. That these texts, in other words, the traditional old ones and the new creative works that are being done by extraordinary groups of writers, many of whom are black and minority group members, that dialogue, I think, is a very constructive one, and you need both parts of it. You need the new work, and you need some awareness of the traditional text as well.
I don't think there are many people who would quarrel with that sort of a noble ambition or goal, Bob Connor, but what do you say to the parents of this country when you persuade them that their children should sit still for courses in literature and philosophy and cultural anthropology, rather than getting real hard-nosed about this and figuring out how this kid's going to make a living over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. What do you say to that?
Well, I think there's plenty of opportunity in almost every institution that I know in the United States for students to get the kind of education that will equip them for jobs out there at graduation. We're not doing zero on that front by any means. But it's also important to realize that we're in an era of amazing change, technological change, and with that comes obsolescence. That a education that's based upon what's practical knowledge today is likely to be an education that's based on what's obsolete knowledge tomorrow. And that's why I think in many ways, if you talk to the parents seriously about this, they realize themselves that some of the perennial issues are ones that students ought to be confronting as part of an education. Some of those basic texts are ones that are going to last when more recent ones from time to time become obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Bob Connor. What about the professors? What about the state of scholarship in this country? Is America still doing world-class work? You can address this from your vantage point as a professor at Princeton and now director of the Humanities Center.
Oh, absolutely. I think American universities in the humanities are doing world-class work that people around the world envy the strength of the American university system. That's been dependent, of course, upon imagination and upon the resources that we've been willing to put into those universities and into research centers as well.
When you say resources, a footnote to this conversation, Bob Connor, money.
Money.
How are we doing? How are we doing in financing this humanistic enterprise?
I think there's serious problems. If we could get 1% of the money that goes in to the research part of the defense budget and 1% of the money that goes in for major technological research in this country, the humanities would have a renaissance that would surprise everyone, I believe.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Robert Connor, the center's new president and director. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 468. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations with two scholars from Cambridge University. My guests will be the parliamentary historian Sir Geoffrey Elton and the political philosopher Quentin Skinner. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. 202 years ago this week, in mid-September 1787, the Constitution of the United States was unanimously approved by the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. The Battle of Antietam took the lives of more than 25,000 Union and Confederate soldiers during the third week in September 1862. Because of a banking crisis, the New York Stock Exchange was forced to close for the first time in its history during mid-September 1873. The planet Neptune was first observed during the third week in September 1846. Mid-September birthdays include the English lexicographer Samuel Johnson, the Swedish actress Greta Garbo, the American jazz pianist Jelly Roll Morton, the English writer H.G. Wells, and the American educator William Holmes McGuffey. Samuel Johnson was born during mid-September 1709, Greta Garbo in 1905, Jelly Roll Morton in 1885, H.G. Wells in 1866, and William McGuffey in 1800. Finally, the third week in September marks a birthday for the ice cream cone. Italo Marchionne's invention, first made of paper, later of pastry, held the frozen delicacies he dispensed from a fleet of pushcarts in New York City. Marchionne applied for a patent during mid-September 1903. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Archaeology in Roman Palestine and the Liberal Arts in America Today, this week on Soundings. Carol and Eric Myers of Duke University discuss the Sepphoris Project, an archaeological program they conduct in Israel. Robert Connor, the new director of the National Humanities Center, discusses the liberal arts in American society today. Archaeology in Antiquity and the Liberal Arts Today, this week on Soundings.